Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the discovery of debris that is likely to be from the Malaysian airliner that disappeared over the Indian Ocean 17 months ago, prompting the most extensive and expensive search in history. Dr. John Hansman, a professor of aeronautics and astronautics at MIT, where he is the director of the MIT International Center for Air Transportation, joins us. He's the chair of the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration's Research, Engineering, and Development Committee, and we will discuss the significance of this discovery and whether it will help explain the mystery of what happened to Malaysian Airlines Flight 370, the Boeing 777 that vanished on March the 8th, 2014, with all 239 passengers and crew on board. Then, on the 50th anniversary of Medicare and Medicaid that was signed into law by President Johnson on July the 30th, 1965, we will look into the health and durability of Medicare that serves 54 million Americans, along with Medicaid that covers 70 million people. Jonathan Oberlander, a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and author of The Political Life of Medicare, joins us to discuss the current attacks on these popular programs from Congressman Paul Ryan, who was recently joined by Republican presidential candidate Jeb Bush, who, speaking before a Koch brothers-sponsored event, called for the phasing out of Medicare, claiming it was not solvent. Then finally, we will speak with one of America's premier military experts, William Arkin, who co-authored the landmark Top Secret America investigation and is the co-author of the national bestseller of the same name. He joins us to discuss his latest book, Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare, and how our security is undermined by the impulse to gather too much data, and that by using drones to avoid putting our troops in danger, we put the rest of us in more danger. And joining us now is Dr. John Hansman, who is the T. Wilson Professor of Aeronautics and Astronautics at MIT, where he's the director of the MIT International Center for Air Transportation. He conducts research in the application of information technology in operational aerospace systems and chairs the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration's Research, Engineering, and Development Advisory Committee, as well as other national and international advisory committees. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. John Hansman.
Happy to be here.
And this breakthrough with the mysterious disappearance of the Malaysian flight MH370 about 17 months ago over the Indian Ocean appears now at least to have the most promising lead, and that is a 9-foot by 3-foot piece of flotsam washed up on the French island of Reunion. And a lot of people are suggesting it's the flapperon from the wing of a Boeing 777. What's your sense of how significant this is?
Well, I think that the evidence we have now is that this does appear to be consistent with being from MH370. The location of where it was picked up was consistent with the drift patterns you would have had from the last expected position of the airplane. I haven't seen the physical evidence directly, but the images appear to be an inboard flap from the scale of the airplane size of the 777. And reportedly, people have looked at it more carefully, have confirmed it appears to be a 777 piece. So it looks like this is a piece of the airplane.
And apparently there was also a discovery of a shredded suitcase that showed up on the island, and now French authorities are conducting helicopter searches along the coast. I assume that because of the westward drift patterns, that the coast of Madagascar and South Africa to the west would also eventually get debris, would they not?
Well, it's possible that they would. This debris, the piece that washed up was a fairly light piece, so it would have floated on the surface. And remember, you're now several thousand miles downstream of the likely impact point. So the wreckage is going to be distributed over a relatively large area, and it's difficult to say when other pieces might wash up, but certainly this will be a place that they're, you know, area they'll be looking.
And in terms of the search itself, apparently that 120,000 square kilometers of the Indian Ocean have been searched at a cost of more than $100 million. And I believe most of that cost is being borne by the Australian authorities. It's probably the biggest search that's been undertaken in history, right?
That's probably correct. I don't know the actual numbers. The search for the Air France airplane in the South Atlantic was also a very extensive search.
And that debris was brought to the very same place in Toulouse, I take it, where the debris that was just picked up in Réunion has been taken.
I'm not sure. I believe that the debris that's come in from La Réunion is going into Paris, and I don't know if that's the same location that was used for the Air France investigation. Could very well be.
So the French have already taken it to France, and the Malaysian authorities have also gone to France. So when do you think there'll be a definitive announcement, given the... Go ahead.
I don't think it'll take very long to confirm that it's actually a piece of a 777. I think that's fairly high confidence now. I'm sure Boeing will also be there and will look at it. Whether they'll be able to identify it from this airplane, they'll probably be able to do that fairly quickly if that's the case. And then they'll go into a deeper investigation of whatever they can infer from the condition of the artifact. So is there any indication from the condition of the artifact that of exactly how the airplane came down? I don't hold a lot of hope that we'll get a lot of insight from this, because it's likely that on any impact, the airplane would have broken up and this piece would have come free. And it's also, if it's found to be from 370, it does indicate that the airplane went down where we all sort of thought it was had gone down. I don't think it will be that helpful at trying to pinpoint the location of the major heavy wreckage, which will be somewhere in the bottom of the ocean.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. John Hansman, who is the T. Wilson Professor of Aeronautics and Astronautics at MIT, where he's the director of the MIT International Center for Air Transportation. He conducts research in the application of information technology in operational aerospace systems and chairs the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration's Research, Engineering, and Development Advisory Committee, as well as other national and international advisory committees. So this is, do you don't think, is going to really help in these, in sort of backtracking to the east of these drift patterns and somehow locating the wreck?
No, I mean, the issue is, you know, you're so far downstream, it's kind of like picking up one particle of smoke, you know, an hour after a fire starts downwind and being able to try to pinpoint the exact location of a campfire. It's very tricky to do because there's so many factors, you know, which will influence the subtle changes in where a piece would end up. So I think it, you know, what it does do is it tells us some of these, you know, wild conspiracy theories of the airplane never went down. It you know, ended up somewhere hidden in a hangar. I think this will dispel some of those notions, but won't give us much insight into actually how the airplane came down and why.
So presumably at least that will end the sort of agonizing speculation on the part of the families of these 239 passengers and crew on board this plane when it went missing. I think half of the passengers were Chinese. So to that extent, I suppose, at least, you know, that has ended some of that sort of agonizing speculation.
Yeah, hopefully it will provide an opportunity for some level of closure to the families.
But surely there's not a lot of scenarios that would explain how an airplane literally was heading north and then did an about turn, headed south, no radio contact, no, I think the transponders were shut down, and then went all the way down the south, ran out of fuel, and crashed into the ocean. So doesn't that lead to, you know, one or two speculations, either that somebody took control of the aircraft and that nobody on board was alive? Or I mean, it sort of leads you to think either there was some peculiar catastrophe that cut off all communications and the plane just sort of was, you know, like a zombie plane, flew all that time until it ran out of fuel, or alternatively, somebody aboard actually made this happen.
Well, I think that we have, you know, there are two sort of inconsistent pieces of data that we have the first turn of the airplane where it was went from its heading north to first heading west and then ultimately south. That appears to be an intentional act by someone on the airplane doing that. There do not appear to be any failure scenarios that I know of that would account for all those changes, you know, including the shutting down of certain radio systems at certain times. We then have the later tracking of the airplane when it was on flying for 5+ hours southbound, which appears to be entirely consistent with autopilot just flying the airplane until a point where it would have, based on the amount of fuel it had, would have run out of fuel. So there are sort of different parts or scenarios, parts of the puzzle. So we do have this long southbound track that appears to be would not have required any human intervention. So it's possible that whoever was in the cockpit was disabled. It was possible that it was intentional. We don't know. And I don't have any clear scenarios that would take you from that first intentional turn to the subsequent turn to the south in this sort of, as you say, zombie flight for the last few hours.
Well, I think, though, when the first turn was made, wasn't there also a climb in altitude?
I don't think that's as clearly defined. That didn't come from the onboard systems, as far as I understand it. There were some reports at the time from radar systems indicating a climb, but those radar systems were not very reliable. Mm. So I'm not sure that data is definitive.
But is there a suggestion that somehow the plane was depressurized and that people would have become unconscious pretty quickly?
I don't think we have any solid data on that.
So, in other words, we may never get an explanation. I mean, even if they find the plane, and I guess the black boxes have long run out of juice, but would they be still, if they were found, would they still be useful?
Not really, in my opinion. That most interesting data would have come from the cockpit voice recorder, particularly at the time the airplane turned initially, and then. But those cockpit voice recorders have a limited recording time. They only record for either 30 minutes or 2 hours. I can't remember exactly on this airplane. So those tapes would have run out or it would have recorded over. So in all likelihood, if there was nobody in the cockpit conscious, you would have just had silence for the last 2 hours. So I don't think, even if you were to find the physical wreckage, that there will be anything definitive that will tell you what happened. So I think this is just going to remain a mystery probably forever.
And there's no way to know what the chances of them finding it are, right? The search continues, but given that they've already looked at 120,000 square kilometers.
This is a very, very difficult search area. The weather's bad. The ocean is very large. It's deep and it's very irregular in the bottom. So it's not that easy to see wreckage on the bottom. And you know, I think for purposes of closure, you know, it was important to keep searching. But in terms of actually figuring out what happened, I'm not very confident that it's actually worth the investment of millions and millions and millions of dollars to try and track this down.
Well, Dr. John Hansman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
No problem.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. John Hansman, who is the T. Wilson Professor of Aeronautics and Astronautics at MIT, where he's the director of the MIT International Center for Air Transportation. He conducts research in the application of information technology in operational aerospace systems and chairs the U.S. Federal Aviation Administration Research, Engineering, and Development Advisory Committee, as well as other national and international advisory committees. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Medicare and Medicaid on its 50th anniversary.
Kiss me and smile for me. Tell me that you'll wait for me. Hold me like you'll never let me go. 'Cause I believe in I hate to go. so no one would know how tired they've grown of talking and telling their lies. Oh, we've got no health insurance, no cellular service, no disease they can cure. But we need more money to burn, so each person must learn the dollar amount they are worth.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jonathan Oberlander, who's a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science. A leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform, he is the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the three-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, second edition. He's currently working on a book project on the politics of health reform. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jonathan Oberlander.
Good to be with you.
And some people in the country are celebrating the 50th birthday of Medicare, going back to LBJ and the Great Society. Medicare, of course, covers almost 54 million Americans and constitutes 14% of federal spending, and Medicaid covers 70 million people. Yet it's under attack, not just Paul Ryan, who has put it under constant attack for some time, but now one of the leading candidates on the Republican presidential side, Jeb Bush, has also called for it to be phased out. So why is this constant battle going on? What's behind it?
Medicare was born in conflict. This was a program that was first proposed in 1952 in a very modest manner. The original Medicare proposal was for 60 days of hospitalization insurance for elderly Americans who were receiving Social Security retirement benefits. And there was a 13-year fight, and it was a vicious fight, an ideological fight, about Medicare from the beginning. And it took a lot, including Lyndon Johnson's breathtaking victory in the 1964 elections, to secure Medicare's enactment. So there has always been conflict around Medicare. What I think has happened, particularly in the last 15 years or so, maybe going back to a generation of 20 years ago, is since Republicans have ascended in Congress, since they retook that congressional majority in 1994, the battle over Medicare has been raised in terms of stakes. And for a long period of Medicare's history, after it was enacted, Medicare politics were relatively quiet. Nobody challenged the existence of the program. There were debates, of course, about how it should be reformed, but its basic structure was not challenged. In the last 15 to 20 years, those challenges have come. You mentioned Paul Ryan, alluding to Jeb Bush's comments earlier this month. And so I think what's going on is we're in a period in American politics where there's extraordinary polarization between the parties, and that polarization is giving rise to cleavages over Medicare that were always there, but they're exposed now.
But do you think in terms of the defenders, I haven't heard what I would consider the most logical defense of Medicare and Medicaid, is that the baby boomers of today would all be bankrupt if they had to take care of their elderly parents without Medicaid or Medicare, and whatever inheritance they might have had would have gone to medical bills.
That's an excellent point. We don't talk enough about the income implications of health insurance. And back in the 1950s and 1960s, the slogan was health insurance for three generations, meaning that Medicare would be for the elderly, but it would also help their children and spare them from the financial burden of taking care of their parents, and in that way help their children's children, their grandchildren, because they would have more money left over for them. Anybody who has seen a bill, a hospital bill, for even a single day will understand immediately where this country would be, where the 50 million plus Medicare beneficiaries and their children would be without the program. It is unimaginable. It is simply unimaginable.
So when Jeb Bush makes these statements about that it's unsustainable, Medicare and Medicaid, my understanding actually from talking to people in the private insurance business, that even in spite of the Affordable Care Act, at the end of the day, we really, as a country, haven't got our hands around the growing percentage of GDP that healthcare takes up. It's about 16%+ now, I understand. Europe and other countries, in Japan and South Korea, are around 7% of GDP. And my understanding is it's not Medicaid and Medicare, even though there's been cases of fraud and stuff that often come up on 60 Minutes reports. But the long and the short of it is that the idea of that the Affordable Care Act would get its hands around these rising costs simply hasn't happened. And that's not the fault of the Affordable Care Act. It's just the fault of the extraordinary inflation in the healthcare business, and particularly pharmaceuticals. And you can trace the reason why pharmaceuticals are out of control to the Republican House that passed a bill that forbids the government from bargaining with Big Pharma over the cost of medicine. And now, I don't know whether you saw the 60 Minutes report on how people are being bankrupted because they're getting expensive cures for cancer, that, you know, a pill is about $14,000, for God's sake.
Yeah, there's no question the United States has a lot of work to do to make medical care affordable. We do have, as you noted, the most expensive system in the world. And if you compare us to our neighbors to the north, Canada, or to Japan, or Germany, or France, or Australia, or England, or the Netherlands, or any of the rich democratic countries, we spend much, much more than they do. And there's no question that we're not getting good value for what we spend, that extra amount of money that we spend. It is also the case that Medicare is less expensive than private insurance, and it has been less expensive than private insurance actually for quite a long time. And so when people talk about privatizing Medicare and they say they want to do it and move the traditional program towards private insurance in order to save money, it's in a sense Orwellian, because if you wanted to save money, you actually probably would move more people out of private insurance into Medicare, not the other way around. The other thing that I think is important to emphasize is that while American medical care is very expensive, the growth in healthcare spending in recent years has been growing at a very moderate clip. And remember, the Affordable Care Act was passed all the way back in 2010, and its critics have lots of apocalyptic predictions of what it would do to healthcare spending. That has not come to pass. And in fact, Medicare spending, the rate of growth in Medicare spending, has slowed down and slowed down considerably. And part of that is due to measures in the Affordable Care Act. So it's a very peculiar time for people like Jeb Bush to be talking about Medicare being unsustainable, because Medicare is actually in much better shape financially today than it has been in quite some time. It's also worth remembering from a historical perspective that people have been saying that Medicare is unsustainable for 45 years. I don't know how many years we have to hit until we can say and admit, okay, maybe Medicare is sustainable, but there aren't many predictions that I would make for you. One of them is this: Medicare is absolutely sustainable. Medicare is never going to go bankrupt, and Medicare is going to go on as far as the eye can see and beyond.
And I suppose the same applies to Social Security, same predictions.
Absolutely.
And same resilience, right?
Absolutely. And this talk about bankruptcy in Medicare is really a sort of political red herring. It's a function of the sort of payroll tax financing that both Social Security and part of Medicare have, where we pay for things through a dedicated financing mechanism, in this case a payroll tax, that goes into the trust fund. And then we get these long-term projections that the programs are going bankrupt. But the thing is, I don't think there are too many members of Congress, even in this Congress, if it's 8% approval rating or so, who would like to run for re-election, going to their constituents saying, we're the Congress that ended Medicare and Social Security.
And again, I'm speaking with Jonathan Oberlander, who's a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he's also a professor in the Department of Political Science. A leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform, he's the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the three-volume series The Social Medicine Reader, second edition. He is currently working on a book project on the politics of health reform. Well, when Jeb Bush made these remarks recently, he made them at a forum sponsored by Americans for Prosperity, which is a group backed by the billionaire Koch brothers. Whether that influenced him, because they're sort of rabid libertarians who don't believe in any government programs at all, or almost any government itself, I think, they'd like to do away with. Is that a factor, do you think, or is it the fact that he just comes from a world of privilege where he simply doesn't recognize how most of us in this country simply don't inherit wealth and don't have that kind of safety net? And as I mentioned earlier, if we didn't have Medicare, we'd all be bankrupt, because assuming we have the moral fortitude to take care of our elderly parents, that healthcare would have bankrupted us under the private system. But Medicare, of course, has enabled the elderly in this country to have a dignified existence in their later years.
Virtually all American families come to rely on Medicare. It really is an all-American program, literally. And of course, let us not forget, it is not just about older Americans. Medicare also provides universal health insurance to Americans who have end-stage kidney disease and need dialysis. It provides health insurance to millions of Americans with permanent disabilities under the age of 65, and they are a population we don't talk nearly enough about in terms of Medicare. So Medicare is an absolutely important part of the social protections that exist in this country. And I think there are times when people who have been fortunate and don't have to rely on federal health insurance lose sight of just how important Medicare is to virtually the rest of the whole country. Now, in terms of what Jeb said, the Bush campaign has not authorized me to speak for him. I do think two things. One is that he probably has benefited from Donald Trump, because that statement that he made about phasing out Medicare is such an extraordinarily risky political statement to make. And I think he's fortunate it's been overshadowed by the circus games in the Republican primary at the moment. The other thing about it, it's an incredible statement for a former governor of Florida to make. And I come from Florida myself, and so can tell you firsthand, we have a few Medicare beneficiaries in Florida. It's just an extraordinary instance of being out of touch. What exactly he meant is not clear. It seems from the context of it that he was alluding to something like the Ryan plan shifting to a defined contribution or modified voucher system for Medicare, or perhaps raising the eligibility age for Medicare benefits. It's not entirely clear, but I think it's not the last time in this campaign you're going to hear a discussion about Medicare.
And to the subject that I mentioned in terms of what is driving the rising and continually rising costs of healthcare in general, and bringing up its percentage of our GDP to over 16, I've heard it's up to 18, but I'm not sure of those figures, but 18% of GDP, that is. The driver, my understanding, is the biggest driver is out of control pharmaceutical costs. Now, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement apparently, according to a lot of angry House Democrats and healthcare advocates, has drug patent provisions in its current draft that are a giveaway to Big Pharma. And the fact that the Republican House a few years back passed this Medicare prescription benefit bill that forbids the government from bulk buying and negotiating prices with Big Pharma, which has led to the out-of-control costs of drugs, particularly compared, as you just did a little while ago, to our neighbour Canada. It's unbelievable how much more we pay for drugs. So what's happening then with the TPP, and is that another fight that we're going to see?
Well, let me say first generally on drugs. Prescription drugs tend to be a relatively modest share of the healthcare dollar. However, it is one of the parts of the healthcare system where people often face the most out-of-pocket costs. And so it's one of the more visible parts of the system. And we just had some data released about healthcare spending for 2014. And in fact, in 2014, there was a very substantial increase in drug spending, over 12%. And a lot of that had to do with high-cost drugs that you're alluding to, including those for treating hepatitis C. Whether that acceleration in drug costs continues in the future remains to be seen. We, as you noted earlier, the politics of regulating the drug industry are very difficult. Pharma has a lot of money and a lot of influence, and a lot of politicians are averse to touching them. Part of the deal that the Obama administration made to get healthcare reform passed in 2010 was to come to terms with the drug industry and say they would not, in essence, intrusively regulate them in exchange for their support for the for passing the Affordable Care Act. So I don't know exactly what's going to happen with the TPP, but I think that the fight over prescription drug spending and over regulating drug costs is one that's not going away anytime soon. And the fact that we're bringing online some very expensive new drugs, and you mentioned before the studies and news that has been out about regarding cancer patients and the immense financial strain that they face with cancer drugs. And now we're bringing online some new anti-cholesterol drugs, cholesterol-lowering drugs that promise to be very expensive as well. So the price of innovation and the price of medical technology, both things that we want, can be extraordinarily high, and figuring out how we square that circle and how we improve what we have but also pay a fair price is something that the U.S. has a lot of work left to do.
Well, just in closing, clearly there have been lots of reports about fraud and abuse in the Medicare and Medicaid program, and perhaps this gives ammunition to the Jeb Bushes and the Paul Ryans of the world. The Government Accountability Office, which is the investigative arm of Congress, says that improper payments cost the federal government $60 billion in Medicare last year, or 10% of the program spending, and $17.5 billion in Medicaid, which is 6.7% of that program's spending. So that's not chump change.
No, and this is not a new story. It's a new report, but we've known about this for quite some time. And medicine is a business in the United States, and a lot of people can make money off it, and a lot of people are making money off it in illegitimate and fraudulent ways. There have been efforts that the federal government has undertaken in the past to try to crack down on fraud in Medicare, and some of those efforts, in fact, about 15 years ago, did pay off and reduce the rate of growth in Medicare spending. And again, this is another one of those battles that is a constant battle.
Well, Jonathan Oberlander, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Jonathan Oberlander, who's a professor of social medicine and health policy and management at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, where he is also a professor in the Department of Political Science. A leading authority on the politics of healthcare and healthcare reform, he's the author of The Political Life of Medicare and co-editor of the three-volume series, The Social Medicine Reader, second edition. He's currently working on a book project on the politics of health reform. We're going to take a brief station break and be back speaking with one of America's premier military analysts on his new book on drones. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is William Arkin, who is a former national security consultant to the New York Times and one of America's premier military experts, having served in Army intelligence in West Berlin during the Cold War. He has written more than a dozen books and been at the center of countless exposés. At the Washington Post, he conceived and co-authored the landmark Top Secret America investigation and co-wrote the national bestseller of the same name. He's also the author of American Coup, and his latest book just out is Unmanned Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Arkin.
Thank you, Ian. Thanks for having me on.
And I guess what's at stake here is that essentially we're swamping ourselves in data to the point, I mean, we know from 9/11, et cetera, that a lot of the information was there. It was just lost in this haystack where we're looking for needles all the time. But also, you're suggesting not only is our security undermined by the impulse to gather too much data, but that the use of drones to avoid putting our troops in danger has put the rest of us in more danger.
Well, I do say that, Ian, and in my book I basically have tried to give a bigger survey of the evolution of drones since 9/11, and then specifically to look at not so much the issues that most people focus on, which is targeted killing per se, but the information, the back end of the drone world. And to me, really the revolution that has occurred in the last decade and a half is that we've gone from 200 drones to 11,000 drones, 15,000 if you count all of those that are used by the United States and its allies. We've gone from probably a situation where there were so few drones flying that everybody could tune in, all the decision makers could tune in and watch actual channels of drones, and even names were used called predator porn or drone crack to describe this kind of mesmerizing picture, to a level now that can hardly even be assimilated by the human eye. And so we've had to disperse the processing, communications, analysis, storage, and retrieval of all of this information into this giant machine. And in many ways, it's made us brilliant, and in many ways, it's made us idiots, because we can do something, and we do it very well. We saw that sort of culminate in 2011 with the death of Osama bin Laden. But since then, as we've killed high-value targets, as they're called, or leaders and lieutenants of ISIS or al-Qaeda or al-Shabaab or whatever organization it might be, we also seem to be stuck in a pattern. We're stuck in a statistical game almost of sort of perfection of doing one thing and an absolute inability to do anything else. So we've created this sort of spying and killing machine that is now meticulous in its ability to find and target an individual, and in that process we've given over the entire concept of war and of strategy and just war in our sort of achievement of this statistical nirvana.
So when you say in your new book, William Marken, Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare, that we have delegated our moral judgments to machines, what explains the outrage that many people do feel about drones? It does elicit quite a lot of passion. And I'm wondering, in terms of morality, and particularly in the morality of war, if that's not an oxymoron, is it more moral to stick a bayonet in somebody's gut and watch them die than zapping them by a drone?
I don't think it's material one bit, but I think that what's happened as we've become more and more unmanned in the pursuit of our military strategies is that we've lost sight of what a just war would look like if we fought a just war. So, not to be too philosophical here, Ian, but let's talk about what war is. War is the last resort. It's what you resort to when you've exhausted all your diplomatic and all your other political possibilities. And what is war? Well, war is something that we have fought under conventions for 6,000 years, and those conventions are that the reason to go to war has to be just, and that the conduct during war has to be just. And what is just? Just is that you conduct yourself during war in such a way that you are able to restore peace. And in the industrial age, we sort of got to the maximum ability to kill, either in grinding industrial warfare of World War I or mechanized warfare of World War II, and then atomic warfare that ended World War II. But in each case, carnage was sort of the victorious element that exhausted states and then forced them to restore the peace. Well, now, you know, like it or not, it's not really material what you think about war. What I've done is done a survey of the war that we've actually fought, and the war that we've actually fought is only really killing maybe, well, I don't know, 200,000, 250,000 people total from 2001 to the present. That's meaning, you know, killed as a result of or in U.S. combat, military and civilian worldwide. And that might have been a bad day in World War II. So you can't look at warfare today in this information age and say, oh, we've become more inhumane. And that's how the military looks at it. They say to themselves, we've become more humane than ever. Hardly anyone is dying compared to the thousands or hundreds of thousands or even millions that died in the industrial wars of our era. And so they don't see anything wrong with what they're doing. In fact, they think we've gotten to a point of precision, which is almost as good as we can do. The President of the United States and other leaders in our country constantly say we're killing without any collateral damage, without any civilians being killed. That's their claim in Pakistan, that no civilians are killed. And so we sort of have gotten to this point now where we are thinking of war in industrial terms. Oh, we have reached this fantastic nirvana of the conduct of war being so different than it was in the industrial age. And yet we are in reality fighting an information war. And that information war that we're fighting is one that is just fundamentally different than the wars of old. And the fact that we can do so with so little impact on our society, no sacrifices, no real involvement of the American people. When I say to most people, Ian, today that, you know, we could be bombing any one of nine countries tomorrow, or that we have bombed any one of nine countries today, and it's not even in the newspapers. So Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Syria, Yemen, Somalia, Nigeria, and on. Most people have to like stop for a moment and think, oh yeah, we're fighting a war that is so unremarkable that unless a civilian gets killed, unless there's a controversy, it's almost like an industrial machine, that the only intervention from humans is when an industrial accident occurs. But otherwise, it's just a machine that goes about its business without any human intervention. And I'm not saying that there aren't people making decisions. There are people making decisions. But the decisions that they are making are now so meticulous and so divorced from the objectives of war as we've articulated them for thousands of years, that we don't see that we've basically just become a nation of assassins and a nation of people who are engaged in individual targeted killing with really no connection to what the overall objectives of war might be.
And again, I'm speaking with William Arkin, who's a former national security consultant to the New York Times and one of America's premier military experts, having served in Army intelligence in West Berlin during the Cold War. He has written more than a dozen books and been at the center of countless exposés. At the Washington Post, he conceived and co-authored the landmark Top Secret America investigation and co-wrote the national bestseller of the same name. He's also the author of American Coup, and his latest book just out is Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. So in terms of perfect warfare, when you mentioned a minute ago, Bill, that the president talks about striking high-value targets without collateral damage, the fact that these drone operators, I believe they're in trailers somewhere outside of Las Vegas, a lot of them are at least, that there have been reports that many of them have have suffered from PTSD. Now, the idea that this is a bloodless video game, that defies that idea. And my assumption is that what these drone operators may find disturbing is that the drones loiter over the targets to do after-action target analysis, and perhaps that's when they see the collateral damage of who they've killed.
You know, there's been a lot written about sort of what is the human cost of this new era of unmanned and drone warfare. I'm not sure that I think that it's the trauma of the pilots and the sensor operators that are the issue. It's more that we as a society, so that means, of course, the young men and women who are drawn into the military today, haven't come to grips with the fact that even though everything is the movement of information and is done in a remote way, that it still constitutes killing. I think if people actually want to be in the military and believe that that's an honorable profession, and then they learn themselves what it means to be in the military and what military honor actually entails, then they could be faced with a situation in drone warfare and unmanned warfare where what happens in this remote way begins to challenge their own training and indoctrination. And so in many ways, military people themselves are the ones who are the quickest to say that killing by a drone is not honorable and is not the way to go. And there's been a history of Air Force and Navy and other services being passive-aggressive or even anti-drone. And so we should remember that the ability to actually fly a drone, put a weapon on it, and then have that drone identify a target and that drone itself kill the target, so it's sort of in one loop, one person, that capability only began in 2001, and it really only matured in 2006 or 2007, probably with the death of Abu Musab al-Zarqawi in 2006. So this is very new in the annals of warfare. So yes, it's true that we see people beginning to morally question the endeavor, but I think we shouldn't confuse our opposition with war or our moral concerns with war with the fact that war is a constant in our society, and how we conduct ourselves inside that is a really important question that is going to also relate to how we build our future security. How we conduct ourselves in warfare is really essential, and we've been letting the accretion of this machine determine our conduct and determine our future more than anything else. And it's time for us to start to take control of that back and to ask ourselves whether or not we're conducting war in the way in which we as the American people, or in the way in which we believe humanity wants to continue to do this unfortunate but obviously omnipresent activity.
Well, who controls the target list, the death list, if you will? My understanding, and I don't know whether you had an opportunity to talk to this person, but apparently he's quite hard to find and quite elusive and an amazing character. The person who's in charge of the death list, as far as I know, is up in Tyson's Corner, in the Director of National Intelligence. He is a convert to Shia Islam, very religious guy, never leaves his office, maybe he goes outside occasionally for a smoke, but literally has the death list. Is that correct information?
That's really not correct.
Right.
Well, you've been reading the news media too much, Ian.
That's true. That's why I checked it with you. Yeah.
Yes. So I don't. There really isn't a single a targeting list. I mean, that's kind of the irony of where we are today. There's an Al Qaeda targeting list. There's a ISIS targeting list. There's an Al-Shabaab targeting list for Somalia. There might be an Al-Qaeda targeting list for Yemen, etc. These are very split efforts. So the day in which we started, like 9/11, with seeing Al-Qaeda as one entity with a hierarchical structure where Osama bin Laden was at the top and then sort of a set of people were in a command structure below. Those days don't exist anymore. Now we're talking about a much more decentralized and much more dispersed adversary that we're fighting, and terrorism is a word. It's not an army. So the selection of individuals also is a matter of tactical significance. So let me explain what that means. If you have a choice in let's say the fight against ISIS of dropping a huge number of bombs on some command installation or some unit of ISIS, we certainly could do that. We have the means to do that. We have the bombers, we have the fighters, we have the ability to do it globally. But if in the process of saying, okay, we want to disable that a structure, that function, whatever that function might be, and it might be the person who is giving the commands, and it might be the means by which the commands are being transmitted, then we start to get into the aesthetic of precision. And the aesthetic of precision is, okay, how can we do it with the least amount of expenditure, with the greatest amount of impact? What is the economy of this action? And if it means that we can use one Hellfire missile, 150-pound short-range missile fired from a Predator or a Reaper drone, to kill one individual to achieve a discrete objective, most people in our nation would say, well, that's a better way to do things. But if you're also on a treadmill in which that's all you do, you're just doing that every day, that you're just accumulating the statistics of this new sport that we call unmanned warfare, with no real way to measure advances or success other than, well, we killed the guy, we killed the target. So how can you argue with us that it's success, that it's not success? We killed the target, and I'm arguing that we've become so mesmerized by this process and by the killing, the meticulousness of the effort to identify the individual and then use the least economy, the greatest economy, the least force in order to kill, that we don't even ask ourselves why we're doing it anymore, and whether or not in doing it we're achieving the broader objective that we set up for ourselves, which obviously is to stop terrorism in the United States and then diminish terrorism worldwide. And I don't think that there's a soul on the planet who thinks that we've done that. We've just been basically playing a game of whack-a-mole for 15 years, and we keep being confounded and bewildered by the emergence of new organizations like Al-Shabaab or Al-Qaeda in Yemen or ISIS, and so that's also the cost that we pay, which is to say that we have a magnificent army of IT workers and software specialists who are now able to basically find and identify and kill individuals down to the individual level, and it may take a decade, but they can do it, and we certainly couldn't do it before. So we have made an advance, but they also, at the same time, it's such an onerous and time-consuming activity, and so complex that we have lost sight of old-fashioned intelligence, which is to say, what's going on in this country, what's going on in with these people, what's going on with this culture, what's going on in this region, that might inform what we want the ultimate outcome of our military action to be.
Well, clearly these advantages that we have don't last forever, like the monopoly over the atomic bomb. And already we lost a very sophisticated drone over Iran, which I understand was hacked into, and that had some very advanced equipment aboard it. Also, we're not immune from the military-industrial complex, from boondoggling. My understanding is that Northrop's Global Hawk is a flying turkey like the F-35 is.
Well, I think that, again, I'm going to admonish you for a minute here and say that you're applying industrial age thinking to the information age. You know, the Global Hawk drone, as an example, was one of the key elements of the tactical victory in the Iraq War in 2003, when everything else was blinded by the mother of all storms that broke out on the 26th of March in 2003, when the ground forces were halted and the fighter planes could no longer fly. A Global Hawk, sitting at 60,000 feet above the clouds with its synthetic aperture radar, was able to see through the clouds and detect Iraqi movements. And through satellite-guided bombs, we were able to essentially destroy the Iraqi army that was mobilizing to defend Baghdad. So that's the true story of the war. Now, you can argue that you don't want that expensive a drone, or you don't like drones, or Northrop Grumman, or you can argue all sorts of things about whether or not these weapon systems work or don't work. I'm telling you, Ian, this is a stupid argument, because the way that the world works, all they're going to respond is to say, well, Ian, if you don't like the way that the F-35 isn't good enough, just cut us another check and we'll make it as good as you want it to be. What's your fundamental problem here, that it doesn't work? And so you set up a sort of argumentation in which essentially you're buying into the military strategy and just saying to the industrial complex or to Washington, just make it economic for me and I'm okay. Make it work and I'm okay. Well, I'm here to say to you, I think these drones do work. That's the problem. It's not that they don't work. It's that they do work. And it's not that we don't have competent people now engaged in this spying and killing apparatus. It is that we do have competent people engaged in this spying and killing apparatus. And so we need to now update our own thinking about what the most effective way is to ensure peace and stability and international security. And I don't think it's arguing anymore industrial arguments about information age problems. Our problem today is too much information, too much of an ability to attack and identify individual targets, and we need to ratchet back our level of activity and consider whether or not this process of meticulous targeted killing is actually achieving the political goal that we want to achieve. If it costs a penny or it costs $1 billion, it's really not material to me if it's not achieving the best for America.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, William Arkin.
Thanks for having me on, Ian.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with William Arkin, who is a former national security consultant to the New York Times and one of America's premier military experts, having served in Army intelligence in West Berlin during the Cold War. He has written more than a dozen books and been at the center of countless exposés. At the Washington Post, he conceived and co-authored the landmark Top Secret America Investigation and co-wrote the national bestseller of the same name. He's also the author of American Coup, and his latest book just out is Unmanned, Drones, Data, and the Illusion of Perfect Warfare. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side and sign up for iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was